We have been discussing the Bhakti Yoga, path of devotion. So, the definition given by Swami Vivekananda, quoting a great devotee, one of the greatest devotees India had produced, Prahlada, was that tremendous attachment which people have towards the worldly object. May I have the same type of attachment, but to you. Nothing is changed here, excepting the direction. So how to attain that kind of attachment? Now you see, people like us think we are very much attached to the world. You know what they say about monkeys? They love their young ones very much. When a danger threatens, mother monkey even doesn't hesitate, throw its young one into fire and walk over it. Even if you need not take it literally, try to that's what most of us do. We are prepared to sacrifice anything, anybody, if it serves our own purpose. Every day, how many divorces are going? How much the partners have helped each other in the beginning? We forget all those things. For a momentary unhappiness, grief, we become so ungrateful. It's not that easy to become really attached to the world. Attachment to the world requires tremendous amount of sadhana. There is a beautiful story. It might be true. There was a great poet in India called Jayadeva. We recite his hymns, the Dashavatara Stotra, etc. He was one of the greatest devotees of Krishna. And his wife Padmavati is one of the chastest women. This Padmavati, the wife of Jayadeva, used to be in the palace along with the queen. And sometimes they used to have conversation. And during one of those chattings, topic of chaste, and they had a discussion, heated argument, who is a chaste woman. And the Padmavati, the wife of Jayadeva, said, she is a chaste woman. If she hears that her husband is dead, immediately she will fall dead. How many women are prepared to break a whiskey bottle at Cape of Riddance? So the queen could not win in argument. She wanted to test. So she is so arranged that once the king had gone on a hunt, and the queen arranged so that Jayadeva also, while they went away, somehow she conveyed the news through some Padmavati, Jayadeva's wife, husband was dead at an accident in the forest while hunting, just to test her. So they were talking, and they, according to the pre-arrangement, a messenger came, conveyed this news. As soon as Padmavati heard this, instantaneously she fell down dead. It is true, some of the chaste men or women may not news that if the long term of marriage, if one partner dies, the other partner is likely to die very soon. Don't you hear such cases? They develop such attachment. But even that is a selfish attachment. Chastity is a spiritual quality. There are many so-called chaste women among you, chaste men, chaste women. That doesn't make many of you spiritual. Why? Because a chaste woman is not merely following a physical faithfulness to the husband. It involves a spiritual outlook. Chaste woman is one who looks upon her husband as God. This has some connection with what we are. I will come. So, even to be attached either to partner or to material things or for name and fame, tremendous amount of spiritual practice is needed. We have a little bit of attachment, not worth being called attachment at all. An old couple were there, 40 years married, and the wife was, one day they were sitting in the parlor, time talking that. So the husband shouted, "Mary, I love you very much." She said, "What?" He went a little bit nearer and again shouted, "I love you very much." "What?" So he went a little bit nearer and shouted again, "I love you very much." She said, "It's all right. I too don't love you." There are examples, and I bring Sri Ramakrishna's teaching, how to attain God. He has given a beautiful analogy bringing this particular topic inside. Three types of attachments, if one can develop and direct all of them towards God, then one will realize God. The love a chaste wife has, the love a mother has for her only child and the love a miser has for worldly objects. There are examples of such loves when if anything happens either to the husband, child or to the property, the man would rather die rather than live in this tremendous attachment. One example, you know, Tulasidasa loved his wife. Another example would be Ratnakara Valmiki, how much he was attached to his wife. So, there was in South India one great saint, singer, poet, saint, Purandaradasa. He was so much attached to money, he was ready to kill his wife or allow his wife to be killed rather than lose his tremendous attachment. The mind is ready and no worldly object contain that love. That is why it is said, even if you want to love anything worldly, go ahead. Don't stop anywhere. Go on loving, go on loving. A time will come when the object self-destruct itself, not in physical sense, unable to contain intensity of love, necessarily turn the direction towards God. Start loving something so intense and no worldly object can ever stand that intense. Necessarily this force will have to be turned towards God. And symbolically, that's what Hindu mythologies illustrate. One example, Ravanasura. He went and prayed to God, gave me tremendous strength. And tremendous strength was given to him. Who can stand him? Because God's power was working in him. So he found all these human beings, not to speak of animals, as unworthy of being fought over. So he turned his attention to God. How to make God fight? Kidnap his wife, Hiranyakashipu, Prahlada's father. He also obtained a boon from Brahma. Nobody in these three worlds will ever be able to overcome. So arrogant, so proud, he was challenging. And people came, one or two people fought with him. Immediately they were destroyed. After that, nobody had ever dared. Now you know what you call muscles started itch. Now you know he was so much of strength is there. What to do? Who is there to fight? And he found out God alone is worthy of being fought. So he started searching. Where is that God whom I can fight? That led him to God and he became liberated. You should not take Hindu mythological stories literally, concretely. They are all symbolical. Every one of those stories is behind. Coming back to our subject, we think we love worldly objects a little bit less, but no more than that. We are frightened for our own puny lives, curity. That is not going to help us. So here also another lesson we have to learn is, how do we develop attachment towards worldly objects? How do we develop? It looks as though it is very easy. You have sweets, you go and eat sweets. That easy to develop because you see, go on eating so many sweets, you become disgusted with them. Try to love another human being. Then you see, very soon, you find lot of defects. See, it is not easy. So how to love? We must become blind. Love is blind. It's a wonderful analogy. You want to love somebody. Blind means do not see anything unworthy, insignificant. See only best. That's what a lover does in case of his or her beloved. See the very best. It is an idea. It is an ideal to be attained. Just as guru is an ideal, which point I will cover sooner. So go on seeing, don't see the defect, see only the positive things. Where do we see it? In the imagination. Everything is in the imagination. That's what meditation is. Develop power of imagination, but selective type of imagination. Only see the very, very great. One example I will give you. Do we need to exercise selective imagination? Yes. We can understand about worldly objects. No worldly thing is perfect. And therefore we need to have selective imagination to be able to love, continue love, to love. What about God? God is a paragon of perfection. Is it not? That is what we utter through our mouth. We do not see. Let some tragedy happen in the family. See what happens. What is this fellow God doing there? He has no work. He should have been protecting my family. Why do we have these accidents, tragedies, unhappiness, that others have it, but not me? See, in the Second World War, A journalist went to find out whether people still believed in God, because London and other cities were, primarily London, was being bombed. So the journalist went to a woman who was living alone, a widow, and the journalist asked her, "Do you still believe in God?" "I pray to him every day." "And then what is the result of your prayer?" "All the bombs fall only on the neighbor's houses." You see, her concept of God is, if she prays to God, then it doesn't matter. They should not fall on her own house. Let them fall anywhere, even the neighbor or anybody else. So this is our idea of God. If things are going on well, we think God is well. Otherwise, no. But that is not true. We should have selective type of imagination about God. What does it mean? It means whatever happens, God still loves us, and whatever happens is for our own good. And in fact, this only way he can bestow his grace, and whatever happens is absolutely good and right and the best. If we can have this kind of selective imagination, then only we really love God or any object. Otherwise, millions of people today have lost faith in God. One of the reasons is so many wars, so much of bloodshed, so much of suffering, and even natural disasters like tsunami, etc. And these make people seriously doubt about God. In the past, they didn't have that kind of problem. History of religion is very closely allied to human history. You see, in the Middle Ages, before the period of Renaissance, when science hasn't risen, the usage of reason, means doubting, wasn't very much prevalent. It might have been there inside, but at least it did not make it out as a physical expression. Freedom wasn't there, society didn't allow it, and because of long tradition, they were, in a way, the brain was completely hypnotized, washed. That's why the doubts did not arise. The second important reason why doubts didn't come was because this life was so miserable under the operation of what they call lords and landlords and fives, that they thought afterlife is far superior in their imagination than living. So if a natural disaster, it is best, because immediately we go to heaven and go on enjoying there. Pious hope. That's what churches have preached. That's what other religions, authorities have preached. But after the period of Renaissance, science began to rise. Science means it's directly related to reason. Reason means always, the first thing reason does is doubt. Do you see the point? Doubt, and we are all fickle type of mind. That's what Swami Vivekananda, Narendranath met Sri Ramakrishna. First thing he asked, "Have you seen God?" That was a very irrational type of question. Never put this question to anybody. Do you know why? Supposing you put this question to me. I say yes. How do you know? Is there any way you can prove to yourself that I have seen God? There are many, many fellows, you know. Internet CV. Self-realized souls. 1008, so and so. Send £50. We'll give you initiation. How do you know the person has seen God? Suppose a person has seen God really and says, "No, I haven't seen God." How do you know that? You have no way to prove or to disprove. So never ask that question. Reason makes us doubt things. Reason has its field, its realm. What is that realm? In this world, supposing you know, you want to come to Vedanta Center. You ask somebody, "Do you know the way to Vedanta Center?" He says, "Yes, yes, I know, I will give you the directions." Then you find him, see, moving like this. Even if he gives directions, you will doubt very much they are right. That's absolutely correct. It should be like that. Find a person sober and knowledgeable, trustworthy, and then you have reasonableness. That's what he says, not otherwise. But in the field of religion, no way you can prove or disprove. So, here coming back, even to attain the tremendous attachment to the worldly objects, we need selective type of imagination. If so, it is exactly the same psychological process is applied to, we do not know anything about God, but we want to love God. How to attain that love for God? So, Swami Vivekananda, having defined what is devotion, it is supreme attachment towards the supreme reality. Both, you must understand, it is the supreme devotion on our part, 100% of what we are capable. And the object also must be the supreme reality, because what else is there besides supreme reality? Supreme unreality. It is unreality. Unreality is unreality. Lost. So your love will be wasted thing. Suppose you love somebody and the person leaves you and goes away. This happened, you know, not exactly same thing. There was a great, here in England, there was a great minister, famous minister. He served his king and the result was king, for some reason, inimical to him, ordered his head to be chopped off. And just before his head was chopped off, he said, "Lord, if only I had served God with as much devotion as I served you, I would have more." The result of serving the king, earthly object, is not only he didn't gain anything, he was losing his life here. Somebody, I think. It's wonderful. These are all wonderful examples. So, we need selective type of imagination. That's where relationship with guru and the disciple comes in. In Hindu tradition, Buddhistic tradition, Jaina tradition, and in selective Catholic traditions, for Russian Orthodox Church, the place given to the teacher, to the spiritual teacher, to the guru, his place is only next to God. And many people, you know, you see, when we are Swamis, when we go out, devotees bowing down to us, touching our feet. And for some of the people who are not that devoted, it is odd. What, one human being touching the feet of another human being is also like us. And we see this, I know this Swami very well. He enjoys ice cream like us. What is his greatness? I heard people here commenting. They are free to do that. The point is, why are the devotees touching the feet? Are they touching the feet of another human being? Or is there something in their minds with which they are doing this action? See, the Swamis don't get anything except paying to touch their feet and wasting their time. The devotees, they get benefit. Do it with the right attitude. So, here the Swami or even God, he is not benefited. So, this is a delusion we have to remove from our minds. You go to the shrine room, bow down to Sri Ramakrishna, he is not getting any benefit. He knows, that's why he goes into samadhi. Who gets the benefit? We get the benefit. What benefit we get? If physically, if we do it, it's a good. There are 50 Swamis. 50 times you have to bow down, you will see how it helps your digestion. Mentally, spiritually, helps us because we are slowly developing that right attitude of reverence. What is spirituality? Developing reverence for everything. Here is a clod of dust. Here is a piece of, doesn't matter what it is. Everything in this universe has its own rightful place, and exactly its scheme. This is nowadays, this is called, you know, this is holistic attitude. Before that, what was the holistic attitude? Now, enlightenment, holistic attitude. Spelling is H-O-L-I-S-T before, W-H-O-L-I-S-T. Holistic means whole. Everything is inter. Everything is one. The most wonderful discovery made of the recent time, the whole universe, the whole creation is one, but with this caveat, it is made up of infinite number of parts. But all these parts put together, something extra comes in, which is not there in every part. You see, here is a lots of pieces of clock, alarm clock. Each part has its own value. It's valueless unless it comes. But when it comes together, it is not merely the sum of all the parts. Something else comes, a beautiful meaning comes. So that is called holistic attitude. By reverencing everything, we are slowly, we are our ability to see things in a new light, in a better light, in a more beautiful light, in a spiritual light. And thereby, our consciousness, the world remains the same. Our consciousness Swami Vivekananda used to say, God grows along with the growth of man. When I was young, it took me some time to understand what this statement really meant. How can God grow? Is he a human being or an animal or a plant? Slowly, slowly from seed state he grows. What he really meant was, our understanding of God grows along with our own growth. As long as we remain on the gross level, we understand God to be gross. As long as we understand him to be a moral being, and only when we become moral, we understand God as the source of all morality. And incidentally, what is the source of all morality? Do you know what is the meaning of morality? Morality, ideal of morality, and the practice of morality should not be confused. Practice of morality, like you help somebody, you tell the truth, etc., etc., this is practice. Ideal of morality, to consider there is no other. All that exists is only me. For example, you know, unselfishness. Towards us, we don't say we are unselfish towards ourselves, do we? Naturally, we are unselfish towards us. We do everything for our own self. We extend the same other, whoever it is in front, human being, whatever it is. Then we call it unselfish. So the idea is, idea of morality is, I am extinguishing the distinction between me and the other. This is what Martin Buber had advocated. Human beings have usually I-it relationship. No, wrong thing to do. I-thou relationship means equal relationship. I and thou, though two words, but actually I am thou and thou is, that is the idea of morality. Without some kind of spiritual, we can understand, is not possible moral. We can do moral practice. So Hinduism has divided morality into two types, worldly morality and spiritual morality. The word used for morality in Sanskrit is dharma. Has many meanings. One meaning is moral life, ethics, unselfish behavior. The other word of dharma, Hindus understand, in the meaning of religion, Hindu dharma, Hindu religion. Here it is not referring merely to moral practice, but it is referring to a spiritual state. Every religion has only one thing to do. It has something to do only with spirituality. Religion has nothing to do with it. Then why does religion deal with morality? Necessary precondition to take one through the spiritual path. One can be moral to some extent without being spiritual. One can never be spiritual without being moral. So the second part of this morality is directed towards spirituality. What is it? What is spirituality? To see God everywhere, is it not? What does it mean to see God everywhere? See oneness, see everything as one, not as many. So morality helps us in the beginning, because slowly our mind becomes purified. But it stops there. Then what happens? What is the result? It is, according to Hinduism, people attain virtue, acquire virtue. That is the meaning of righteous, be righteous. People do virtuous deeds, kind of morality is practiced. But the result is, they will be enjoying in this world very much, or they can go after death to heavenly worlds. But even heaven or this world, everything is considered as worldliness only, opposed to spirituality. But somebody may be there on Himalayas, completely out of touch any society. He will be just meditating, thinking of God, doing japa, praying, a spiritual practice. You may ask, where is his morality? Because morality can be practiced only in society when there is somebody else. Where is the question of being truthful or unselfish when you are the only person there? But still, there is a spiritual morality there. What is that spiritual morality? He is slowly acquiring that vision of unity, of oneness, of perceiving that oneness. The meaning of seeing God. You don't see a human being with four hands. You see, Hindus don't consider anybody with two hands as God. At least they must have four hands. Somebody asked an ant, you know, do you believe in God? Yes, of course, certainly. And do you think God is a huge ant? He said, of course, that is God, but that is not the only thing. Huge sting. That's what human beings, you know, if ant has got small sting, its God would be having a huge sting. If we have got two hands, God must have at least four, if not more. And if we have got two eyes, God must have at least three eyes, if not more. That is why Lord Shiva has got, you know, a third eye. We can only, you know, multiply whatever we know to be. We cannot escape it. So, what is this person doing, sitting there? He is practicing spiritual morality, acquiring slowly the vision. But then he also would be able to come down and then see, not as we see the world, in a lofty way, spiritual way. That is why very often these saints are forced to come to the society to complete their spiritual practice very often. It's very easy to go there very peaceful in a cave where there is nobody to disturb us. Live in a place where there is the selfish people, there are cruel people, there are wicked people, and then exhibit our spirituality is very, very difficult, unless one have a vision. So, morality is nothing but seeing oneness in everything. Limitations. The vision has to start from within. Change the duality. Overcome the multiplicity. See the oneness. Go to the very root. Say, where we are completely equal. How to get rid of this differentiation and be able to see that oneness is not possible. One morning we read some great spiritual book and go and say, now I am going to see everything as God. That is why most of us are disappointed in our spiritual life, you know. You go and sit for meditation, very happy, and you come out and somebody, you know, criticizes you and your blood pressure will rise. Instead of spiritual pressure, blood pressure only will rise. So, it's very necessary to kind of preliminary things. We must start somewhere. Spiritual means to be able to see divinity somewhere in small things. You can't take up anything and say, here is a lady's bag, I will start seeing God. You don't need to see all pickpockets, that's what they see God only there. So that is why Hinduism has developed these various systems suitable for various types of people upon their spiritual progress. This is where idolatry comes. What is idolatry? Worshipping an idol. Every Hindu practical has a shrine, has some pictures or idols. And you see this, even it could be symbolical idols. There's small stones. There are two types of such stones. One is called Shivalinga, representative of, and another is representative of Vishnu Shaligrama. And with what reverence the Hindu looks upon our pictures, our icons, or even trees. Some Vaishnavas, they respect so much a small plant, basil plant, tulsi. And the followers of Shiva respect another tree. It is called bale tree. So certain types of flowers, plants, certain types of trees, for example, Ashwatha, these are representative. It is not that they are divine. In fact, everything is divine only. Everything is God only. But we do not have the vision. But we are able to develop that. We must start somewhere. So all these idols are created. Infinite number of idols. We are all idolaters only, in fact. There are so many ignorant type of people who think, oh, we are not idolaters. We are very enlightened people. One such person went to Ramana Maharshi and said, should you not teach people, especially Hindus, that they should not worship idols? He laughed and said, show me one man who is not an idolater. What do you do from morning till evening? Get up, ceremoniously wake yourself up. Your alarm clock will be having rock and roll music. Ceremoniously you drink bed coffee, tea. Ceremoniously you bathe yourself with how many things nowadays, you know. Visit the bathroom of anybody. Hundreds of, you know, shampoos and creams and powders and my God. And there also, you know, towels. His, hers. What is this? and then ceremoniously eat, you go to a Tesco, Marks and Spencer. How the whole shelves are filled up with varieties of, thousands of varieties of food material. Ceremoniously you select them. For what purpose? Ceremoniously to feed ourselves. From morning till evening, what are we doing? Worshipping this idol called the body. And these are the people who want to give advice to others. Don't be an idolater. Many Muslims, you know, they how many broken, how many beautiful images they had destroyed. Even now they do it, if they get the opportunity. They do not understand how much this helped people to become spiritual. Nobody is bowing down to a stone, to a tree. Everybody is trying to say, this is just a kind of peg for our devotion to develop. Oh Lord, please help me, so that the mind can be focused, can be concentrated. So Swami Vivekananda, he starts his Bhakti Yoga, how to develop devotion. And he divided devotion into two parts. One is the preliminary devotion, another is the mature devotion, Vaidhi Bhakti and Raga Bhakti. Necessarily, we have to start with formal religion. Formality means you worship God, you go on pilgrimages, you go fasting, you do japa, you pray, guru, etc. Of these, having a guru, one of the most in Catholic religion, Russian Orthodox, those of you who have read his Way of a Pilgrim, remember how this man had sought a starage, a guru. And his guru is an ideal. As I mentioned earlier, a guru is an ideal. I also have to tell you something. Our life in this world is only a journey. Why do we develop so much love for husband, for wife, children, for friends, etc.? They are all idols, targets for us, so that we slowly develop capacity, love. Capacity, attachment is nothing but misdirected love. So everybody is an ideal, everybody is an idol. Wife, husband, everybody is an idol. So we go on developing our muscles, devotional muscles, if wish. Spiritual muscles. Develop our love slowly, 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 slowly. The same principle applies to the guru also. Guru is an ideal. Then who is the guru? The real guru, Chidananda. God only is the real guru. Knowledge is the real guru. Realization is the real guru. Everything else is a kind of help for us. So if somebody is bowing down to a guru, then he is not bowing down to any human being. He is not bowing down to an object. He is not bowing down to a material thing. He is only exercising his spiritual muscles so that he can develop the tremendous love. So what is it? You see, here is a guru. And we should be having selective imagination about the guru, as I mentioned earlier. What is selective? Whatever is my guru. Even if he is a lecherous fellow. Even if he is the most unworthy fellow. There is a Bengali, there is a saying, you know, even if my guru goes to a toddy shop, he is for me Sachidananda, Pramananda. What is the idea here? The idea is not what the guru is. The idea is, how do I react towards the guru? And why can't we do the same thing towards our family members? That was the ideal, as I mentioned. Chaste husband always considers his wife as, and a chaste wife always considers her husband as God himself. This is called selective. Does she not know that he likes to have more ice cream? Does she not know that he likes to sleep in his bed without doing anything? One couple were there. Both of them were working in the office. And the husband used to come and lord it over. So one day he came, sat down in the easy chair. He expects his wife, you know, to unlace his boots, prepare the coffee, etc. And she also just came in, simply came and said, prepare. She said, no, you prepare your own coffee. No, no, it's wife's duty to do it. You have to do it. He says, no, no. It is the man's duty, husband's duty actually. All over Bible being written. The Bible it is written, it's man's duty to prepare all this tea and coffee. He says, can you show me? Yes. Brought the Bible and said, you know, many pages, Hebrews, Hebrews. So this kind of, the wife knows very well all the defects. That's not the point. The point is, in spite of all those defects, how to consider him as the supreme divinity, manifestation. If the wife can do it, she need not have any other guru. Moral of the story, we have discussed many times, the chaste wife, the virtuous wife, who taught a lesson to an ascetic, that by just serving parents or husband or some people in the society, with a spiritual outlook, any person can become spiritual. That's what Sri Ramakrishna had really taught. The husband looked upon the wife as divine mother's, part of divine mother. And the wife also looks upon him as part of the divine being. But you know, there is a psychological fact. Familiarity breeds. You go and stay with somebody, and immediately you start, you know, feel, oh, I know all about this. From outside I thought you were such a great man, but now I know he or she is. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, human beings will have human frailties, and even great people exhibit human traits. For example, you know, Sri Ramakrishna loved ice cream. Swami Vivekananda loved ice cream. Yeah, in fact, he died of, you know, diabetes, the result of eating too much of ice cream. Just joking. He voluntarily gave up his body, but he became very fat. Once he was giving a talk, inspired talk, orator, you know. And by that time, he ate a lot of ice cream, big. And at the end of the lecture, some lady got up in America. Swami, have you realized God? Down, smiled broadly and said, do I look like that? You know, we judge people from outside. Sometimes some great people assume these human frailties, either voluntarily or just as a habit. We are incapable of seeing at what level their mind is living. Swami Brahmananda used to eat, you know, William Bhatt and Gopal Gappa and Mughlai tea and all those. If anybody sees Swami Brahmananda when he was eating all those things, man, it's worse than me. I don't eat so many. We judge. So selective type of imagination is, that's where guru plays a great role. What is it? You select a guru. But before selecting the guru, you exercise all your intellect. But we don't do that. We don't do in many things. We don't do it in marriage. Nowadays, marriage is breaking down because we don't select the partners. We are emotional creatures. So I feel very good with you. But emotion is always unsteady. It's like soda water bottle foam. How long will it last? The real life starts only after the show is over. Films, you know, the hero, heroine fall in love. And then the villain comes, kidnaps and bangs the hero and all that. And after that, after a lot of fight and all those things, then the hero beats the villain, black and blue, united with the beloved. And ever after, we don't show what happens. The real life starts only after that. That's because we are the living examples of what happens after. So we need to select a guru whom we think have that love and reverence. It needs tremendous sincerity, spiritual qualification. You know, many of you have studied the Gospel of Ramakrishna, complete works of Swami Vivekananda, Ramakrishna Mission literature. Ultimately, if you have to squeeze, what is the essence of Sri Ramakrishna? As you know, there are two important Sri Ramakrishna's first teaching is realize God, the only goal of life. And on the practical level, he said, there are many ways, many pathways which can take us to God. Every pathway is called a religion. All religions are true, valid. Now, many of us read these things, but we might come to some wrong conclusion that we are free. We can do whatever we like, take any religious path that takes our fancy. There are five important points from Sri Ramakrishna's which we must always keep in mind. What are those? One religion. Only one religion. Select whatever religion you want. But one scripture. There are thousands of scriptures, modern and ancient, and many thousands will come in future. There is no end. Take one scripture which would be your guide for your whole life. Then one guru. No question of changing the guru. And if anybody thinks, oh, that guru was useful for 10 years. Now a new model is required. No, because it is an ideal. If you do that, we become spiritually prostitute. One guru, one mantra. Whatever guru says, this is your mantra. Not only life, but life after life. And one form of God. God has many forms, but we need only one form. These are the five things. One religion, one scripture, one guru, one mantra, and one form of God. Based upon this, you try to understand Sri Ramakrishna's teachings or Vedantic teachings, Swami Vivekananda's teachings. So this is where the relationship between the guru and the sin. Hindus believe in many lives, is it not? So Hindus believe the relationship between a wife and a husband, chaste wife and a chaste husband, is not life after life. It is the same wife. It is the same guru. Same disciple will have same guru. Eternal guru. The belief of him, one of the major beliefs of Hindus. Once I accept a guru, this is the same guru will come. In the next life. It is an eternal relationship. How can there be an eternal relationship when we go on changing, the guru changes his disciples and the disciples change the gurus? How can there be an eternal relationship? But then the doubt may come. How can there be an eternal relationship when our bodies are changing? Next life, how do I know that the same guru will come? Will he have the same face? The point is, guru is an ideal. Guru is a direction. Guru is a teaching. The same teaching will come because God will come in that form, in any form, and he knows this person has advanced this. Now, the next lesson he needs is this particular. There is only one guru. Eternal relationship is possible only when there is one guru. And who is that guru? God, who is within each one of us. He is the only guru. Sri Ramakrishna used to tell, who is the guru? Satchidananda is the guru. Satchidananda means God. He is the only guru. He comes in different forms. It doesn't matter to you. You also don't remember what happens in the next birth. But he will come right to you at the right time. Pick you up where you are. Slowly guide you. His duty ends only when disciple attains liberation. That is why guru is given so much of reverence. This guru cult, it has become almost a cult with all its good and bad points. We'll discuss in our next class. I think that would be on the 28th. Om Shanti Shanti.